out discovering what he could about Checo's whereabouts. But Checo's own spies were everywhere, and it wasn't long before Ezio learned that Checo was aware that he was closing in, and was planning to take off in a caravan of two carriages with the apple, in order to escape from him and foil his plans. On the morning Checo planned to depart, Ezio was ready, keeping a close watch on the southern gates of Nubilaria, and soon the two carriages he'd been expecting rumbled out through them. Ezio mounted his horse to give chase, but at the last moment a third, lighter carriage, driven by an Orsi henchman, came fast out of a side street and deliberately blocked Ezio's path, causing his horse to rear and throw him. With no time to waste, Ezio was obliged to abandon his steed and, jumping up, clambered onto the Orsi carriage, felling its driver with a single blow and throwing him to the ground. He whipped up the horses and gave chase. It wasn't long before he had his adversary's vehicles in sight, but they saw him too and increased their speed. As they pelted down the treacherous mountain road, Checo's escort carriage, filled with Orsi soldiers who were preparing to fire their crossbows at Ezio, took a corner too fast. The horses broke their traces and raced on round the bend ahead, but the carriage, its steering gear gone and its hafts empty, shot straight on over the edge of the road and crashed hundreds of feet into the valley below. Under his breath, Ezio thanked fate for her kindness. He urged his own horses on, worried that he would drive them too hard and cause their hearts to burst, but they were pulling less weight than the animals pulling Checo's carriage, and steadily made up the distance that separated Ezio from his quarry. As Ezio drew level, the Orsi coachman struck out at him with his whip, but Ezio caught it in his hand and pulled it free. Then, when the right moment came, he let go of his own reins and leapt from his carriage to the roof of Checo's. In panic, the horses of his carriage, relieved of both the weight and the control of a driver, bolted and careered out of sight down the road ahead of them. "Get the hell off!" yelled Checo's driver, alarmed. "What in God's name do you think you're doing? Are you crazy?" But without his whip, he was finding it harder to control his own team of horses. He had no leisure to fight. From inside the carriage, Checo himself was shouting, "Don't be a fool, Ezio! You'll never get out of this!" Leaning half out of the window, he lunged at Ezio with his sword, while the coachman frantically tried to control the horses. "Get off my carriage, now!" The driver tried deliberately swerving the carriage to throw Ezio off, but he clung on for dear life. The carriage veered dangerously, and at last, as they were passing a disused marble quarry, it ran completely out of control, crashing onto its side and throwing the driver heavily onto a pile of slabs of marble of all sizes that had been sawn out by the masons and then abandoned owing to faults that ran through the stone. The horses were pulled down in their traces, pawing the ground in frantic terror. Ezio jumped clear, landed in a crouch, and had his sword out ready for Checo, who, winded but unhurt, was clambering out, fury in his face. "Give me the apple, Checo. It's all over." "Imbecile! It'll be over when you're dead!" Checo swung his sword at his opponent, and immediately they were cutting and slashing at each other, dangerously close to the edge of the road. "Give me the apple, Checo, and I'll let you go. You have no idea of the power of what you have." "You'll never have it! And when my master does, he will have undreamed-of power, and Lodovico and I will be there to enjoy our share of it." "Lodovico is dead. And do you really think your master will let you live once your usefulness to him is over? You already know too much." "You killed my brother. Then this is for you, for his sake." Checo rushed at him. They closed, blades flashing, and Checo struck at Ezio again, his sword deflected by the metal arm guard. The fact that his well-aimed blow had not struck home momentarily put Checo off his guard, but he quickly recovered and struck a blow at Ezio's right arm, cutting deeply into his bicep and causing him to let his weapon fall. Checo gave a hoarse cry of triumph. He held the point of his sword at Ezio's throat. "Don't beg for mercy," he said, "for I'll give you none." And he drew back his arm to drive in the fatal blow. At that instant, Ezio unleashed the double-bladed dagger from its mechanism on his left forearm and, swinging round with lightning speed, rammed it into Checo's chest. Checo stood stock still for a long moment, looking down at the blood dripping onto the white roadway. He dropped his sword and fell against Ezio, clutching onto him for support. Their faces were close. Cecco smiled.
"So, you have your prize again," he whispered, as the lifeblood pumped out faster from his chest.
"Was it really worth it?" asked Ezio.
"So much carnage."
The man gave what sounded like a chuckle, or it might have been a cough, as more blood flooded his mouth.
"Look, Ezio, you know how hard it will be for you to hold on to a thing of such value for long."
He fought for breath.
"I am dying today, but it will be you who dies tomorrow."
And as the expression faded from his face, and his eyes rolled upwards, his body sank to the ground at Ezio's feet.
"We shall see, my friend," Ezio told him. "Rest in peace."
He felt groggy. Blood was pouring from the wound in his arm, but he made himself walk to the carriage and calmed the horses, cutting them free of their traces. Then he searched the interior and quickly located the teak box. Opening it quickly to ensure that its contents were safe, he reclasped it shut again and tucked it firmly under his good arm. He glanced across the quarry, where the driver lay inert. It wasn't necessary to verify that the man was dead, for the broken angle of the body told him everything. The horses had not moved far, and Ezio went over to them, wondering if he had the strength to mount one and use it at least to get him part of the way back to Forli. He hoped he would find everything there as he had left it, for his tracing of Cecco had taken far longer than he'd hoped or expected. But he had never pretended that his work would be easy, and the apple was back in assassin control. The time he had spent had not been in vain. He looked at the horses again, deciding that the lead beast would be his best choice of the four. He went to put his hand on its mane to pull himself up, for it was not equipped with riding tack, but as he did so, he staggered. He had lost more blood than he'd thought. He would have to bind up his wound somehow before he did anything else. He tethered the horse to a tree and cut a strip from Cecco's shirt to use as a bandage. Then he dragged the body out of sight. If anyone came by, they would assume, if they did not look too carefully, that Ezio and the driver had been the victims of a tragic road accident. But it was getting late, and there would be few travellers abroad at this hour. However, the effort drained the last of his resources. "Even I have to rest," he thought, and the thought was a sweet one. He sat down in the shade of the tree and listened to the sound of the horse as it gently grazed. He placed the teak box on the ground beside him and took one last cautious look round, for this was the last place he should remain for long. But his eyelids were heavy, and he did not see the silent watcher concealed by a tree on the knoll which rose above the road behind him. When Ezio awoke, darkness had fallen, but there was just enough moonlight for him to see a figure moving silently near him. Ezio's right bicep ached dully, but when he tried to raise himself with his good left arm, he found he could not move it. Someone had brought a slab of marble from the quarry and used it to pin the arm down. He struggled, using his legs to try to stand, but he could not. He looked down to where he had left the box containing the apple. It was gone. The figure, who was dressed, Ezio saw, in the black cappa and white habit of a Dominican monk, had noticed him wake, and turned to him, adjusting the marble slab so that it held him more securely. Ezio noticed that a finger was missing from one of the monk's hands. "Wait," he said. "Who are you? What are you doing?" The monk didn't reply. Ezio could see the box as the monk stooped to pick it up again. "Don't touch that! Whatever you do, don't—" But the monk opened the box, and a light as bright as the sun shone forth. Ezio thought he heard the monk give a sigh of satisfaction, before he passed out again. When he woke again, it was morning. The horses were all gone, but with daylight, some of his strength had returned. He looked at the marble slab. It felt heavy, but it did move slightly when his arm moved under it. He looked around. Just within reach of his right hand, he could see a stout branch that must have fallen from the tree at some point in the past, but which was still green enough to be strong. Gritting his teeth, he picked it up and maneuvered it under the slab. His right arm hurt like hell, and started to bleed again as he wedged one end of the branch under the slab and heaved. A half-forgotten line from his school days had flashed through his mind. "Give me a lever long enough, and I will lift the earth." He pushed hard. The slab started to move, but then his strength failed him and it fell back into place again. He lay back, rested, and tried again. At the third attempt, screaming inwardly with pain, and thinking the muscles of his wounded right arm would tear through the skin, he pushed again, as if his very life depended on it, and finally the slab rolled over onto the ground. Gingerly he sat up. His left arm was sore, but nothing was broken. Why the monk had not killed him as he slept, he had no idea. Perhaps murder was not part of the man of God's plan. But one thing was certain. The Dominican and the apple were gone. Dragging himself to his feet, he found his way to a nearby stream and drank thirstily before bathing his wound and redressing it. Then he set off eastwards back over the mountains towards Forli. At last, after a journey of many days, he saw the towers of the town in the distance. But he was tired, drained by his unremitting task, by his failure, by his loneliness. On the journey back, he had had plenty of time to think about Christina and what might have been, had he not been given this cross to bear. But since he had, he could not change his life. Nor, as he realized, would he. He had reached the far end of the bridge to the southern gate, and was close enough to see people on the battlements, when exhaustion finally overcame him, and he passed out. When he next awoke, it was to find himself lying in a bed covered in pristine linen sheets, out on a sunny terrace shaded by vines. A cool hand stroked his forehead, and pressed a beaker of water to his lips.
"Ezio, thank God you are back with us. Are you all right? What happened to you?"
The questions flowed from Caterina's mouth with all her usual impetuosity.
I don't know. "They saw you from the ramparts. I came out personally. You'd been travelling for I don't know how long, and you have a horrific wound."
Ezio struggled with his memory.
"Something is coming back to me now.
I had retrieved the apple from Cecco. But there was another man who came soon afterwards. He took the apple."
"Who?"
"He wore a black hood like a monk, and I think had a finger missing." Ezio struggled to sit up.
"How long have I been lying here?"
"I have to go, right away." He started to rise, but it was as if his limbs were made of lead, and as he moved, a terrible dizziness overcame him, so he was obliged to lie back again.
"Oh, what did that monk do to me?"
Caterina leaned over him.
"You can't go anywhere yet, Ezio. Even you need time to recover if you're to fight the battles well which lie ahead. And I can see a long and arduous journey in front of you. But cheer up. Niccolo has returned to Florence. He will look after the matters there. And your other fellow assassins are vigilant, so stay a while."
She kissed his forehead, then, tentatively at first, his lips.
"And if there is anything I can do to hasten your recovery, you have only to say the word."
Her hand began very gently to wander downwards beneath the sheets until she found her objective.
"Wow," she smiled. "I think I am already succeeding. A little."
"You are quite a woman, Caterina Sforza." She laughed.
"Tesoro, if ever I were to write the story of my life, I would shock the world."
Ezio was strong and still, at 30 years old, a young man in his prime. Moreover, he had undergone some of the toughest training known to man, so it was really no wonder that he was up and about again sooner than most would have been. But his right arm had been severely weakened by Cecco's blow, and he knew he needed to work hard to recover the full strength he required to resume his quest. He made himself be patient, and under Katerina's strict but understanding guidance, spent his enforced time at Forli in quiet contemplation, when he could often be found sitting under the vines lost in one of Poliziano's books, or, more frequently, in vigorous exercise of every kind. And then a morning came when Katerina arrived in his chamber to find him dressed for travel and a page helping him pull on his riding boots. She sat on the bed beside him. "So the time has come," she said. "Yes, I can delay no longer." She looked sad and left the room, to return not long afterwards with a scroll. "Well, the time had to come," she said, "and God knows your task is more important than our enjoyment, for which I hope another time will come round again soon." She showed him the scroll. "Here, I have brought you a leaving present."
"What is it?"
"Something you will need."
She unrolled it, and Ezio saw that it was a map of the entire peninsula, from Lombardy to Calabria, and all across it, as well as the roads and towns, a number of crosses were marked on it, in red ink.
Ezio looked up at her.
"It's the map Machiavelli spoke of."
"Your husband's?"
"My late husband's, mio caro.
Niccolo and I made a couple of important discoveries while you were on your travels. The first is that we timed our removal of dear Girolamo rather well, for he just about completed his work on this. The second is that it is of inestimable value, for even if the Templars have the apple, they cannot hope to find the vault without the map."
"You know about the vault?"
"Darling, you can be just a tad naive at times. Of course I do." She became more businesslike. "But fully to disarm our enemies, you must recover the apple. This map will help you bring your full great task to an end."
As she handed him the map, their fingers touched, lingered, and entwined. And their eyes would not leave each other's.
"There is an abbey in the wetlands near here," Katerina said at last. "Dominicans. Their order wears black hoods. I'd start there."
Her eyes were shining, and she looked away.
"Now go. Find us that troublesome monk."
Ezio smiled. "I think I'm going to miss you, Katerina." She smiled back a bit too brightly. For once in her life, she was finding it hard to be brave.
"Oh, I know you will."
Chapter 24
The monk who welcomed Ezio at the Wetlands Abbey was as monks should be, plump and rubicund, but he had flaming red hair and puckish, shrewd eyes, and spoke with an accent Ezio recognized from some of the condottieri he'd encountered in Mario's service. The man was from Ireland.
"Blessings on you, brother."
"Grazie, padre.
I am Brother O'Callaghan."
"I wonder if you can help me."
"That's why we're here, brother. Of course, we live in troubled times. It's hard to think straight without something in our stomachs."
"You mean something in your coin purse?"
"You take me wrong. I'm not asking you for anything."
The monk spread his hands.
"But the Lord helps the generous."
Ezio shook out some florins and passed them across.
"If it's not enough."
The monk looked reflective.
"Ah, well, the thought is there. But the truth is that the Lord actually helps the slightly more generous."
Ezio continued shaking out coins until Brother O'Callaghan's expression cleared.
"The Order appreciates your open-handedness, brother."
He folded his hands on his belly.
"What do you seek?"
"A black-hooded monk who lacks one of his 10 fingers.
Brother Guido has only 9 toes. Are you sure it wasn't a toe?"
"Quite sure."
"And then there's Brother Domenico. But it's his entire left arm he's lacking."
"No, I'm sorry, but I'm quite sure it was a finger." The monk paused, deep in thought.
"Now wait a moment. I do recall a black-cowled monk with only 9 fingers. Yes, of course. It was when we had our last San Vincenzo's feast at our abbey in Tuscany."
Ezio smiled. "Yes, I know the place. I'll try there.
Grazie. Go in peace, brother."
"I always do." Ezio crossed the mountains westwards into Tuscany, and though the journey was a long and difficult one, as autumn approached and the days became unkinder, he felt his greatest trepidation when he approached the abbey, for it was the place where one of those implicated in the plot to assassinate Lorenzo de' Medici, Jacopo de Pazzi's secretary, Stefano de Bagnoni, had met his end at Ezio's hands long ago. It was unfortunate that the abbot who greeted him here was one who had been a witness to that killing. "Excuse me," Ezio said to him first. "I wonder if you can—" But the abbot, recognizing him, drew back in horror and cried, "May all the archangels, Uriel, Raphael, Michael, Sarakel, Gabriel, Ramil, and Raguel, may they all in their mightiness protect us." He turned his blazing eyes from heaven to Ezio. "Unholy demon, begone!" "What's the matter?" said Ezio in consternation.
"What's the matter? What's the matter? You are the one who murdered Brother Stefano, on this holy ground."
A nervous group of brothers had gathered at a safe distance, and the abbot now turned to them.
"He has returned! The killer of monks and priests has returned!"
he pronounced in a voice of thunder, and then took flight, followed by his flock. The man was clearly in a state of high panic. Ezio had no choice but to give chase. The abbey was not as familiar to him as to the abbot and his troop of monks. At last he tired of hurtling round unfamiliar stone corridors and cloisters, and leapt to the rooftops to get a better view of where the monks were headed. But this only threw them into a greater panic, and they started to scream, "He's come! He's come! Beelzebub is come!" And so he desisted and stuck to conventional means of pursuit. Finally, he caught up with them. Panting, the abbot rounded on him and croaked,
"Begone, demon! Leave us alone! We have done no sin so great as thine."
"No, wait, listen," panted Ezio, almost equally out of breath. "I just want to ask you a question."
"We have called down no demons upon us. We seek no journey to the afterlife just yet."
Ezio placed his palms downwards.
"Please, calma. I wish you no harm."
But the abbot wasn't listening. He rolled his eyes.
"My God! My God, why have you forsaken me? I'm not yet ready to join your angels."
And he took to his heels again. Ezio was obliged to bring him down in an arms-to-feet tackle. They both got up, dusting themselves down in the middle of a circle of goggling monks.
"Stop running away, please," pleaded Ezio.
The abbot cowered.
"No, have mercy. I don't want to die," he burbled.
Ezio, conscious that he was sounding prim, said,
"Look, Father Abbot, I only kill those who kill others. And your brother Stefano was a killer. He tried to murder Duke Lorenzo in 1478.
He paused, breathing heavily.
"Be reassured, Messer Abate, I am certain you are no such thing as a murderer."
The abbot's look became a trace calmer, but there was still suspicion in his eyes.
"What do you want, then?" he said.
"All right now, listen to me. I'm looking for a monk dressed like you are, a Dominican, who is missing a finger."
The abbot looked wary.
"Missing a finger, do you say? Like Fra Savonarola?"
Ezio seized on the name.
"Savonarola? Who is he? Do you know him?"
"I did, Messer. He was one of us, for a time."
"And then?" The abbot shrugged.
"We suggested he take a nice long rest at a hermitage in the mountains. He didn't quite fit in here."
"It seems to me, Abate, that his time as a hermit may be over. Do you know where he may have gone now?"
"Oh, dear me," the abbot searched his mind.
"If he's left the hermitage, it may be that he has returned to Santa Maria del Carmine in Florence. It's where he studied.
Perhaps that's where he'd go back to."
Ezio breathed a sigh of relief. "Thank you, Abbot. Go with God." It was strange for Ezio to be in his hometown again after so long. There were many memories to deal with, but circumstances dictated that he work alone. He could not contact even old friends or allies, lest the enemy were alerted. It was also clear that even if the city remained stable, The church, at least, which he sought, was in turmoil. A monk came running from it in fear. He accosted the monk.
"Whoa there, brother, it's all right."
The monk looked at him wild-eyed.
"Stay away, my friend, if you value your life."
"What's happened here?"
"Soldiers from Rome have seized our church. They've scattered my brothers, asking questions that make no sense. They keep demanding that we give them fruit."
"What kind of fruit?"
"Apples."
"Apples?"
"Diavolo, Rodrigo has got here before me," hissed Ezio to himself. "They've dragged one of my fellow Carmelites behind the church. I'm sure they're going to kill him."
"Carmelites? You are not Dominicans." Ezio left the man and made his way carefully round the outer walls of Santa Maria, hugging them. He moved as stealthily as a mongoose confronting a cobra. When he reached the walls of the church's garden, he skimmed to the roof. What he saw below him took even his experienced breath away. Several Borgia guards were beating the shit out of a tall young monk. He looked about 35 years old.
"Tell us," cried the leader of the guards. "Tell us, or I will make you hurt so badly you'll wish you'd never been born. Where is the apple?"
"Please, I don't know. I don't know what you're talking about."
The lead guard leaned in close.
"Confess. Your name is Savonarola."
"Yes, I told you, but you beat the name out of me."
"Then tell us and your suffering will cease. Where the fuck is the apple?"
The interrogator kicked the monk savagely in the crotch. The monk howled in pain.
"Not that that'll make much difference to a man in your missionary position," jeered the guard.
Ezio watched, deeply concerned. If this monk was indeed Savonarola, the Borgia thugs might kill him before he himself got the truth out of the man.
"Why do you keep lying to me?" sneered the guard. "My master will not be pleased to hear you made me torture you to death. Do you want to get me into trouble?"
"I don't have any apple," sobbed the monk. "I'm just a simple friar. Please let me go."
"In a pig's eye.
I know nothing,"
the monk cried piteously.
"If you want me to stop," shouted the guard, kicking him again in the same place, "then tell me the truth, brother Girolamo Savonarola."
The monk bit his lip, but stubbornly replied,
"I told you everything I know."
The guard kicked him again, and had his henchmen grab his ankles and drag the man mercilessly along the cobbled ground, his head bouncing painfully on the hard stone. The monk screamed and struggled in vain.
"Had enough, you abominato?"
The lead guard held his face close again.
"Are you so ready to meet your maker that you would lie again and again just to see him?"
"I am a plain monk," wept the Carmelite, whose robes were dangerously similar in cut and colour to that of the Dominicans. "I have no fruit of any kind, please."
The guard kicked him again, in the same place, again. The monk's body twisted in an agony beyond tears. Ezio had had enough. He sprang down, a phantom of vengeance, slicing for once in pure rage with poison dagger and double blade. Within a minute of sheer slaughter, the Borgia thugs, all of them, lay either dead or groaning in the same agony they'd inflicted on the flagstones of the courtyard. The monk, weeping, clung to Ezio's knees.
"Grazie, grazie, Salvatore."
Ezio stroked his head. "Calma, calma. It will be all right now, my brother." But Ezio also looked at the monk's fingers. All 10 were intact. "You have 10 fingers," he murmured, disappointed despite himself.
"Yes," cried the monk, "I have 10 fingers, and I don't have any other apples than those that come to the monastery from the market every Thursday."
He stood up, shook himself down, tenderly readjusted himself, and swore.
"In the name of God! Has the whole world stopped making sense?"
"Who are you? Why did they take you?" asked Ezio.
"Because they found out that indeed my family name is Savonarola. But why should I betray my cousin to those thugs?"
"Do you know what he's done?"
"I know nothing. He's a monk like me.
He chose the harsher order of the Dominicans, it is true, but..." "He has lost a finger?"
"Yes, but how could anyone..."
A kind of light was dawning in the monk's eyes. "Who is Girolamo Savonarola?" persisted Ezio.
"My cousin, and a devoted man of God.
"'And who, may I ask, are you? "'Though I thank you humbly for my rescue, "'and owe you whatever favour you may ask.'
"'I am nameless,' said Ezio. "'But do me the favour of telling me your name.'
"'Fra Marcello Savonarola,' the monk replied meekly.
Ezio took that in. His mind raced.
"'Where is your cousin Girolamo?'
Fra Marcello thought, struggling with his conscience.
"'It is true that my cousin has a singular view of how to serve God. He is spreading a doctrine of his own. You may find him now in Venice.
And what does he do there?
Marcello straightened his shoulders.
I think he has set off on the wrong path. He preaches fire and brimstone. He claims to see the future.
Marcello looked at Ezio through red-rimmed eyes, eyes full of agony.
If you really want my opinion, he spews madness.
Chapter 25 Ezio felt that he had spent too long on what seemed to be a fruitless quest. Chasing Savonarola seemed like chasing a will-o'-the-wisp, or a chimera, or your own tail. But the search had to continue, remorselessly, for the nine-fingered man of God held the apple, the key to more than he could imagine possible, and he was a dangerous religious maniac, a loose cannon potentially less controllable than the master, Rodrigo Borgia, himself. It was Teodora who met him as he disembarked from the Ravenna galley at the Venice docks. Venice, in 1492, was still under the relatively honest rule of Doge Agostino Barbarigo. The city was abuzz with talk of how a Genoese seaman called Cristofa Corombo, whose mad plans to sail westwards across the ocean sea had been turned down by Venice, had got funding from Spain and was about to set out. Had Venice itself been mad not to fund the expedition? If Corombo succeeded, a safe sea passage to the Indies might be established, sidestepping the old land route now blocked by the Ottoman Turks. But Ezio's mind was far too full of other matters to pay much attention to these matters of politics and trade.
"'We have your news,' Teodora said. "'But are you certain?'
"'It's the only lead I've got, and it seems a good one. "'I'm certain that the apple is here again in the hands of the monk, Savonarola. "'I hear he preaches to the masses of the hell and fire to come.
"'I have heard of this man.
"'Do you know where he can be found, Teodora?'
"'No.
"'But I've seen a herald drawing crowds in the industrial district, "'preaching the kind of fire and brimstone stuff and nonsense you speak of.'
Perhaps he is a disciple of your monk.
Come with me. You will certainly be my guest while you are here, and once you're settled we will go straight to where this man delivers his sermons.
Both Ezio and Teodora, and indeed all intelligent and rational people, knew why a kind of blood and thunder hysteria was beginning to grip the people. The half-millennium year of 1500 was not far off, and many believed that that year would mark the second coming, when the Lord would come with clouds in his own glory and the glory of his Father, with 10,000 of his saints, even myriads of angels, and shall sit upon the throne of his glory, and before him shall be gathered all nations, and he shall separate them one from another, and shall set the sheep, the saved, on his right hand, and the goats, the damned, upon the left. San Matteo's description of the Last Judgment reverberated through the imaginations of many.
"'This herald and his boss are really cashing in on the febbre de fine secolo,' said Teodora. "'For all I know, they believe in it themselves.'
"'I think they must do,' said Ezio. "'The danger is that with the apple in their hands, they may actually bring about a world disaster that has nothing to do with God and everything to do with the devil.' He paused. "'But for the moment they have not unleashed the power they have, and thank God for that, for I doubt if they would know how to control it. For the moment, at least, they seem content to foretell the apocalypse. And that, he laughed bitterly, has always been an easy sell.
But it gets worse, said Teodora. Indeed, you might almost believe that the apocalypse were really at hand. Have you heard the bad news?
I have heard none since I left Forli.
Lorenzo de' Medici has died at his villa in Careggi.
Ezio looked grim.
That is indeed a tragedy. Lorenzo was a true friend to my family,
and without his protecting hand I fear I may never recover the Palazzo Auditore. But that is as nothing compared with what his death may mean to the peace he maintained between the city-states. It was always fragile at the best of times.
"There is more," said Theodora. "And it is, if anything, worse news even than Lorenzo's death." She paused. "You must brace yourself for this, Ezio. The Spaniard, Rodrigo Borgia, has been elected Pope. He rules the Vatican and Rome as the supreme pontiff, Alexander the VI."
"What? By what devilry?"
"The conclave of Rome has only just ended, this month. The rumour is that Rodrigo simply bought most of the votes. Even Ascanio Sforza, who was the most likely candidate standing against him, voted for him. 4 mule loads of silver was his bribe, they say.
What profits him to be Pope? What is it he seeks?"
"Is such great influence not enough?" Theodora looked at him. "Now we are in the power of a wolf, Ezio. The most rapacious, perhaps, the world has ever seen."
"What you say is true, Theodora. But the power he seeks is even greater than that which the papacy will give him. If he controls the Vatican, he is that much closer to gaining access to the vault. And he is still on the trail of the apple, the piece of Eden he needs to give him the power of God himself."
"Let us pray that you get it back into the hands of the assassins. Rodrigo as Pope and Master of the Templars is dangerous enough. Once he has the apple as well..." She broke off. "As you say, he will be indestructible."
"It's odd," said Ezio.
"What is?"
"Our friend Savonarola doesn't know it, but he has 2 huntsmen chasing him."
Theodora conducted Ezio to the large open square in the industrial quarter of Venice, where the herald was wont to conduct his sermons, and left him there. Ezio, his hood up and his face lowered but watchful, blended in with the crowd that was already gathering. It wasn't long before the square was packed, the mob thronging around the small wooden stage onto which a man now stepped, an ascetic-looking man with cold blue eyes and hollow cheeks, iron-grey hair and gnarled hands, dressed in a plain grey woolen robe. He started to speak, pausing only when the mad cheers of the crowd obliged him to. Ezio saw how skilfully one man could work hundreds into a state of blind hysteria.
"Gather, children, and hear my cry, for the end of days draws nigh. Are you ready for what is to come? Are you ready to see the light my brother Savonarola has blessed us with?"
He raised his hands, and Ezio, who knew exactly what light the herald was referring to, listened soberly.
"Dark days are upon us," continued the herald. "But my brother has shown me the path forward unto salvation, unto the heavenly light that awaits us. But only if we are ready, only if we embrace him. Let Savonarola be our guide, for he alone knows what is to come. He shall not lead us astray."
Now the herald leant forward earnestly on the lectern before him.
"Are you ready for the final reckoning, brothers and sisters? Whom shall you follow when the time comes?"
He paused again for effect.
"There are many in the churches who claim to offer salvation, the summoners, the pardoners, the scatterbrained slaves of superstition. But nay, my children, they are all enthralled to the Borgia Pope, all enthralled to Pope Alexander, the 6th and most mortgaged of that name."
The crowd screamed. Ezio inwardly winced. He remembered the apparent prophecies he had seen the apple project in Leonardo's workshop. Somewhere in the distant future, a time when hell would truly be unleashed upon the earth, unless he could stop it.
"Our new Pope Alexander is not a spiritual man. He's not a man of the soul. Men like him buy your prayers and sell your benefices for profit. All the priests of our churches are ecclesiastical merchants. Only one among us is a true man of the Spirit. Only one among us has seen the future and spoken with the Lord. My brother, Savonarola, he shall lead us."
Ezio thought, had that mad monk opened the apple as he had himself? Had he unleashed the same visions? What was it Leonardo had said about the apple? Unsafe for weaker brains.
"Savonarola shall lead us to the light," the herald was concluding. "Savonarola shall tell us what is to come. Savonarola shall carry us to the front door of heaven itself. We shall not want in the new world that Savonarola has borne witness to. Brother Savonarola walks the very path to God we have been seeking."
He raised his hands again as the mob yelled and cheered. Ezio knew that the only way to find the monk was through this acolyte, but he had to find a way to reach the man without arousing the suspicions of the devoted crowd. He made his way forward cautiously, acting the role of the meek man seeking conversion to the herald's flock. It wasn't easy. He was jostled aggressively by people who could see he was a stranger, a newcomer, a person to be regarded with reserve. But he smiled, bowed, and even, as a last resort, threw money down, saying, "I want to give alms to the cause of Savonarola and those who support him and believe in him." And money worked its usual charm. In fact, Ezio thought, money is the greatest converter of them all. At last, the herald, who'd observed Ezio's progress with a mixture of amusement and contempt, bade his minders step aside and beckon to him, leading him to a quiet place, a little piazzetta off the main square, where they could have a private conversation. Ezio was pleased to see that the herald clearly thought he'd made an important and wealthy new addition to his flock. "Where is Savonarola himself?" he asked.
"He is everywhere, brother," replied the herald. "He is at one with all of us, and all of us are at one with him." "Listen, friend," said Ezio urgently. "I seek the man, not the myth. Please tell me where he is."
The herald looked at him askance, and Ezio clearly saw the madness in his eyes.
"I have told you where he is. Look, Savonarola loves you just as you are. He will show you the light. He will show you the future.
But I must talk to him myself. I must see the great leader, and I have great riches to bring to his mighty crusade." The herald looked cunning at that.
"I see," he said. "Be patient. The hour is not yet come. But you shall join us in our pilgrimage, brother."
And Ezio was patient. He was patient for a long time. Then, one day, he received a summons from the herald to meet him at the Venice dockyards at dusk. He arrived early, and waited impatiently and nervously, until finally he saw a shadowy figure approaching through the evening mists. "I was not sure you would come," he greeted the herald. The herald looked pleased.
"The quest for truth is passionate in you, brother, and it has withstood the test of time. But now we are ready, and our great leader has assumed the mantle of command he was born to. Come."
He motioned ahead of him, and led Ezio to the quayside where a large galley waited. Near it, a crowd of the faithful waited. The herald addressed them.
"My children, it is time at last for us to depart. Our brother and spiritual leader, Girolamo Savonarola, awaits us in the city he has at last made his own." "Yes, he has. The son of a bitch bastard has brought my town and my home to its knees, to the brink of insanity."
The crowd and Ezio turned to look at the person who had spoken. A long-haired young man in a black cap, with full lips and a weak face, now contorted in anger.
"I have just escaped from there," he continued. "Thrown out of my dukedom by that prick King Charles of France, whose meddling has caused me to be replaced by that dog of God, Savonarola."
The crowd's mood turned ugly, and they would surely have seized the young man and thrown him into the lagoon if the herald had not stayed them.
"Let the man speak his mind," ordered the herald,
and turning to the stranger, asked,
"Why do you take Savonarola's name in vain, brother?"
"Why? Why? Because of what he's done to Florence. He controls the city. The Signoria are either behind him or powerless against him. He whips up the mob, and even people who should know better, like Maestro Botticelli, follow him slavishly. They burn books, works of art, anything which that madman deems immoral."
"Savonarola is in Florence now," asked Ezio intently.
"You're sure?" "Would it were otherwise. Would he were on the moon or in hell's mouth. I barely got away with my life."
"'And who might you be exactly, brother?' asked the herald, impatient now and showing it. The young man drew himself up. "'I am Piero de' Medici, son of Lorenzo il Magnifico, and rightful ruler of Florence.' Ezio clasped his hand. "'Well met, Piero. Your father was my staunch friend.' Piero looked at him. "'Thank you for that, whoever you may be. As for my father, he was lucky to die before all this madness broke like a giant wave over our city.' He turned heedlessly to the angry crowd. "'Do not support that wretched monk. He is a dangerous fool with an ego the size of the Duomo. He should be put down like the mad dog he is.' Now, as one, the crowd growled in righteous fury. The herald turned to Piero and yelled, "'Heretic! Seeder of evil thoughts!' To the crowd he cried, "'This is the man who must be put down. Be silenced. He must burn!' Both Piero and Ezio by his side had their swords out by now, and faced the menacing mob. "'Who are you?' asked Piero.
"'Auditore, Ezio,' he replied.
"'Ah! Sono grato del tuo aiuto! My father spoke of you often.' His eyes flickered over their adversaries. "'Are we going to get out of this?'
"'I hope so, but you weren't exactly tactful.'
"'How was I to know?'
You've just destroyed untold effort and preparation. But never mind, look to your sword. The fight was hard but short. The two men let the mob beat them back to an abandoned warehouse, and it was there that they took their stand. Luckily, though enraged, the crowd of pilgrims were far from being seasoned fighters, and once the boldest of them had retreated nursing deep cuts and slashes from Ezio's and Piero's long swords, the rest of them fell back and fled. Only the herald, grim and grey, stood his ground.
"'Imposter!' he said to Ezio. "'You shall freeze forever in the ice of the fourth ring of the ninth circle, and it is I who will send you there!'
From his robes he produced a keen-edged basilard and ran at Ezio, holding it above his head, ready to strike. Ezio, backing, almost fell, and was at the herald's mercy. But Piero sliced at the man's legs, and Ezio, having regained his feet, unleashed his double blade, punching the sharp points deep into the man's abdomen. The herald's whole frame shuddered with the impact. He gasped and fell, writhing and twitching, clawing the ground, until at last he was still.
"'Hope that pays you back for the bad turn I've done you,' said Piero, with a rueful smile. "'Come on. Let's get to the Doge's palace and tell Agostino to send a watch out to make sure that bunch of lunatics are split up and that they've all gone back to their kennels.
Grazie, said Ezio. But I go the other way. I go to Florence.
Piero looked at him incredulously. What? Into the mouth of hell itself?
I have my own reasons for seeking out Savonarola. But perhaps it's not too late to undo the damage he's done to our native city as well.
Then I wish you luck, said Piero. Whatever end you seek.
Chapter 26 Fra Girolamo Savonarola took over the effective government of Florence in 1494, aged 42. He was a tormented man, a twisted genius, and the worst kind of fanatical believer. But the most frightening thing about him was that people allowed him not only to lead them, but to incite them to commit the most ludicrous and destructive acts of folly, all based on a terror of hellfire and on a doctrine which taught that all pleasure, all worldly goods, and all the works of man were despicable, and that only by complete self-abnegation could a person find the true light of faith. No wonder, thought Ezio, pondering these things as he rode towards his hometown, that Leonardo stayed put in Milan. Apart from anything else, from his friend's point of view, Ezio had learned that homosexuality, hitherto winked at or punishable by an affordable fine, was once again a capital offence in Florence. And no wonder, too, that the great materialist and humanist school of thinkers and poets, who had gathered around the nurturing and enlightened spirit of Lorenzo, had broken up and sought less barren soil than the intellectual desert which Florence was fast becoming. As he approached the city, Ezio became aware of large groups of black-robed monks and soberly attired laymen heading in the same direction. All looked solemn but righteous. All walked with their heads bent.
"Where are you bound?" he asked one of these passers-by. "To Florence, to sit at the feet of the great leader," said a pasty-faced merchant, before continuing on his way. The road was broad, and approaching him from the city, Ezio saw another mass of people, evidently leaving town. They also walked with their heads bent, and their expressions were serious and depressed. As they passed him, Ezio heard snatches of their conversations, and realized that these people were going into voluntary exile. They pushed carts piled high, or carried sacks or bundles of possessions. They were refugees, banished from their home either by edict of the monk or by choice, since they could bear to live under his rule no longer.
"If Piero had had only a tenth of his father's talent, we'd have somewhere to call home," said one.
"We never should have let that madman gain a foothold in our city," muttered another. "Look at all the misery he's wrought."
"What I don't understand is why so many of us are willing to accept his oppression," said a woman.
"Well, anywhere's better than Florence now," another woman said. "We were just thrown out when we refused to hand over everything we owned to his precious Church of San Marco."
"It's sorcery. That's the only way I can explain it. Even Maestro Botticelli is under Savonarola's spell."
"Mind you, the man's getting old. He must be damn near 50. Maybe he's hedging his bets with heaven. Book burnings, arrests, all those endless bloody sermons. And to think what Florence was just 2 short years ago. A beacon against ignorance. And now here we are again, back mired in the Dark Ages." And then a woman said something which made Ezio prick up his ears.
"Sometimes I wish the assassin would return to Florence, that we might be free of this tyranny."
"In your dreams," replied her friend, "the assassin's a myth, a bogeyman parents tell their children about."
"You're wrong.
My father saw him in San Gimignano," the first woman sighed.
"But it was years ago."
"Yeah, yeah, se lo tu dici." Ezio rode on past them, his heart heavy. But his spirits rose when he saw a familiar figure coming along the road to meet him.
"Salute, Ezio," said Machiavelli, his serious, humorous face older now, but more interesting for the etching of the years.
"Salute, Niccolo."
"You've picked a fine time for a homecoming."
"You know me. Where there's sickness, I like to try to cure it."
"We could certainly use your help now," Machiavelli sighed. "There's no doubt Savonarola couldn't have got where he is now without the use of that powerful artifact, the apple." He held up his hand. "I know all about what has happened to you since last we met. Caterina sent a courier from Forli 2 years ago, and more recently one arrived with a letter from Piero in Venice. I'm here for the apple. It has been out of our hands far too long."
"I suppose in a sense we should be grateful to the ghastly Girolamo," said Machiavelli. "At least he kept it out of the new Pope's hands."
"Has he tried anything?"
"He keeps trying. There's a rumour that Alexander's planning to excommunicate our dear Dominican. Not that that'll change much around here."
Ezio said, "We should get to work on retrieving it without delay."
"The apple?"
"Of course.
Though it'll be more complicated than you might think."
"Ha! When isn't it?" Ezio looked at him. "Why don't you fill me in on things?"
"Come, let's go back to the city. I'll tell you everything I know. There's little to relate. In a nutshell, King Charles VIII of France finally managed to bring Florence to its knees. Piero fled. Charles, land-hungry as ever, why the hell they call him the Affable is beyond me, marched on to Naples, and Savonarola, the ugly duckling, suddenly saw his chance and filled the power vacuum. He's like any dictator anywhere, tinpot or grand, totally humourless, totally convinced, and filled with an unshakable sense of his own importance. The most effective and the nastiest kind of prince you could wish for." He paused. "One day I'll write a book about it."
"And the apple was the means to his end?"
Machiavelli spread his hands.
"Only in part. A lot of it, I hate to say, is down to his own charisma. It isn't the city itself he's enthralled, but its leaders, men possessed of influence and power. Of course, some of the Signoria opposed him at first, but now—" Machiavelli looked worried. "Now they're all in his pocket. The man everyone once reviled suddenly became the one they worshipped. If people didn't agree, they were obliged to leave. It's still happening, as you've seen today. And now the Florentine Council oppress the citizens and ensure that the mad monk's will is done. But what of decent, ordinary people? Do they really act as if they had no say at all in the matter? Machiavelli smiled sadly. You know the answer to that as well as I do, Ezio. Rare is the man willing to oppose the status quo. And so, it falls to us to help them see their way through this. By now, the two assassins had reached the city gates. The armed guards of the city, like all police, serving the interest of the state without reference to its morality, scrutinized their papers and waved them through, though not before Ezio had noticed another pack of them busy piling up the corpses of some other uniforms who carried the Borgia crest. He pointed this out to Niccolo. "Oh, yes," said Machiavelli. "As I said, friend Rodrigo, I'll never get used to calling the bastard Alexander, keeps trying. He sends his soldiers into Florence, and Florence sends them back, usually in pieces." "So he does know the apples here." "Of course he does. And I must admit, it's an unfortunate complication." "And where is Savonarola?"
"He rules the city from the Convento di San Marco, almost never leaves it. Thank God Fra Angelico didn't live to see the day Brother Girolamo moved in."
They dismounted, stabled their horses, and Machiavelli arranged lodgings for Ezio. Paola's old house of pleasure was shut down, along with all the others, as Machiavelli explained. Sex and gambling, dancing and pageantry were all high on the list of Savonarola's no-nos. Righteous killing and oppression, on the other hand, were fine. After Ezio was settled, Machiavelli walked with him towards the great religious complex of St. Mark. Ezio's eyes ranged the buildings appraisingly. A direct assault against Savonarola would be dangerous, he decided, especially with the apple in his possession.
"True," agreed Machiavelli.
"But what other option is there?
Aside from the city leaders, who doubtless have vested interests, are you convinced that the people's minds are fundamentally their own?"
"An optimist might be inclined to take a bet on it," said Machiavelli.
"My point is, they follow the monk not by choice, but by dint of force and fear."
"No one apart from a Dominican or a politician would argue with that."
"Then I propose we use this to our advantage. If we can silence his lieutenants and stir up discontent, Savonarola will be distracted and we'll have a chance to strike."
Machiavelli smiled.
"That's clever.
There ought to be an adjective to describe people like you."
"I'll speak with La Volpe and Paola."
"Yes, they're still here, though they've had to go underground. They can help us organize an uprising as you free the districts."
"Then it's settled."
Ezio was troubled, though, and Machiavelli could see it. He led him to the quiet cloister of a little church nearby and sat him down.
"What is it, friend?" he asked.
"Two things, but they are personal."
"Tell me."
"My old family palazzo."
"What's become of it?"
"I hardly dare go to look."
A shadow passed across Machiavelli's face.
"My dear Ezio, be strong.
Your palazzo stands, but Lorenzo's ability to protect it lasted only as long as his own power, his own life. Piero tried to follow his father's example, but after he was kicked out by the French, the Palazzo Auditore was requisitioned and used as a billet for Charles's Swiss mercenaries. After they had moved south, Savonarola's men stripped it of everything that was left in it and closed the place down. Have courage. One day you will restore it."
"And Annetta?"
"She escaped, thank God, and joined your mother at Monteriggioni."
"That at least is something."
After a silence, Machiavelli asked, "And what is the second thing?"
Ezio whispered, "Christina."
"You ask me to tell you hard things, amico mio." Machiavelli frowned. "But you must know the truth." He paused. "My friend, she is dead." Manfredo would not leave, as many of their friends left after the twin plagues of the French and Savonarola.
He was convinced that Piero would organize a counter-offensive and get the city back. But there was an horrific night, soon after the monk came to power, when all those who would not voluntarily commit their belongings to the bonfires of the vanities which the monk organized to burn and destroy all luxurious and worldly things, had their houses ransacked and put to the torch. Ezio listened, making himself stay calm, though his heart was bursting. Savonarola's fanatics, Machiavelli went on, forced their way into the Palazzo d'Arzenta. Manfredo tried to defend himself, but there were too many pitted against him and his own men, and Christina would not leave him. Machiavelli paused for a long moment, fighting back tears himself. In their frenzy, those religious maniacs cut her down too. Ezio stared at the whitewashed wall in front of him. Every last detail, every last crack, even the ants moving across it, all were thrown into dreadful focus. Chapter 27. How every hope of ours is raised in vain. How spoiled the plans we laid so fair and well. How ignorance throughout the earth doth reign. Death, who is mistress of us all, can tell. In song and dance and jousts some pass their days. Some vow their talents unto gentle arts. Some hold the world in scorn and all its ways. Some hide the impulses that move their hearts. Vain thoughts and wishes, cares of every kind, greatly upon this erring earth prevail, in various presence after nature's law. Fortune doth fashion with inconstant mind. All things are transient here below and frail. Death only standeth fast for evermore. Ezio let the book of Lorenzo's sonnets fall from his hand. The death of Christina made him all the more determined to remove its cause. His city had suffered long enough under the rule of Savonarola. Too many of his fellow citizens, from every conceivable walk of life, had fallen under his spell, and those who disagreed were either discriminated against, driven underground, or forced into exile. It was time to act. "We have lost to exile many people who might have helped us," Machiavelli explained to him. "But even Savonarola's chief enemies outside the city-state, I mean the Duke of Milan and our old friend Rodrigo, Pope Alexander VI, haven't been able to dislodge him." "And what of these bonfires?" "The most insane thing of all. Savonarola and his close associates organize groups of their followers to go from door to door, demanding the surrender of any and all objects they deem to be morally questionable, even cosmetics and mirrors, let alone paintings, books considered to be immoral, all sorts of games, including chess, for God's sake, musical instruments, you name it.